There's a river flowing.
In the additional conversation with Stephanie Jones, we explored how development lives inside everyday interactions, relationships, emotional experiences, and reflective practice. We explored the idea that development is not something separate from ordinary life in schools and communities, but development unfolds through it. Stephanie, your point about the fact that education and child development is process, not product, is so important. And if we apply it to ways people sometimes think about social and emotional learning, even if they're thinking about the process, they think about it in those spaces that are formally defined as schools.
Yes. Often process, they do. Yeah. Or traditionally, maybe they do.
And we know that children grow and develop 24/7. And we also know that many students and young people spend lots of time in out-of-school spaces that are sometimes out-of-school learning and development spaces. You've done work there as well. So if you could talk about the implications of your work, of strategies and kernels there, that would be helpful.
Yeah. So one of the things I hear you saying is that you said social emotional learning is 24/7. And I would say that again to emphasize it, but a slightly different way, which is like social emotional learning, social and emotional skills, they're every day, like every moment, every day. So every interaction carries something social and emotional in it. Right? Because it's inside of interactions and relationships and emotions and features of social interaction. It's all that stuff. And so whether it's in school or out of school or at home or in a community-based setting, inside of sports, in music, in art, it's all there all the time. And we, in our original thinking about the kernels, we imagined them as part of their design, that they would be deeply flexible and adaptable. One of the challenges that we were responding to in part was that some perceive the kind of curricular approach, the programmatic approach, which is nothing wrong with it, but still some perceive it to be inflexible. And part of that stems from like the world of evidence-based programs, which is if you design it and then test it, if you want to see the impacts of that thing in a new place, you have to do it the way it was designed and ideally the way it was originally studied. And so that feels inflexible to me. And one of our early interests with the kernels was to design something that could be closely tied to evidence, as we talked about before, and adaptable. So to do that, you have to get simple and local. And an early sort of, I don't know, collaborator in the kernel's work were folks who were working in settings, educational settings that were non-traditional, non-formal, and characterized by turbulence and vulnerability and adversity. So those who are working actually primarily in settings of education and emergency saw the kernels as something that could fit in like a turbulent, non-predictable kind of setting. And so I'm not trying to say that after school is like that, but after school does have some of the characteristics of lack of formality and not necessarily tons of structure and lots of different activities that a social emotional learning strategy could ally with or align with or be integrated into. So after school is like a natural setting for that idea, which is you need something that doesn't have a formal structure. You need something that you can deploy in flexible ways. And you need something that I think is like the holy grail of what folks want from social emotional learning, which is something that can be integrated into instructional work or other kinds of things like sports or music or art. And so after school is one of those places where all that stuff is happening, and it's happening differently in different configurations, one place to the next, even in the same place, even in the same district or state or whatever. We were contacted maybe 10 years ago by a group working in Nebraska, in particular working with 21st Century Community Learning Centers. And they were really interested in this kind of adaptable, integratable approach to SEL that could sit inside after school and inside after school that is varied even inside of a place. And so we engaged in a kind of multi-year collaborative effort to look closely at the kernels, to think about what after school educators really saw as the priorities for after school in their settings, the particular needs and strengths that they brought to the collaboration. And we did a kind of co-redesign where we did workshops with after school staff and we presented them with the materials and said, like, how would you reconfigure these so that they suited your particular work and your setting? And then we applied for a federal Department of Education grant to do a more robust kind of pilot, collaborative design and pilot, and then a randomized trial of the kernels in after school in Nebraska, which is just about to close its second year. And we have some first year findings from it.
Do you want to share those pieces of findings?
They're not published yet, but we have messed with them enough to know that they don't go away when you do things to the models, which is my like criterion for it's real.
Yeah.
You no matter what you do to it, the findings don't go away. And after a year, which in this case, given the time to training and getting everybody implementing was about 5 months of implementation in after school settings, serving elementary aged children, our study is focused on K to two. We see statistically significant improvements in children's executive function, their self-regulation, and in educator instructional practices, socially, emotionally relevant instructional practice in the setting.
When I listen to you, besides be listening in agreement, I'm also listening as someone who many years ago was dean of a school of human services that supported many people who went into youth work. And also was living with my wife who was training Head Start people. And what I'm hearing as a potential for the kernels and strategy both is the way of equipping the entire force of people, and that could include parents and members who support young people to have a greater array of tools that they can apply and adapt in the moment as long as they understand the underlying principles.
Yes.
That has the potential of being the fluoride in water.
Yes, it's the active ingredient.
Yeah, and I say that, again, thinking historically to an event at the Carter Center where I was talking about SEL. I was on a panel. This is back around 2011. And Carl Bell, a wonderful psychiatrist, ended up saying, isn't this the penicillin? And I tried to say, I'm not sure anything is a penicillin. But I was still in a program mentality, in spite of the fact that I was skeptical.
Which is perfectly fine.
No, I know.
You can mount it and do it well.
Oh, I know.
No problems.
No, but I would say my long-term lesson over time is that fidelity is not replication exactly. No matter, fidelity is adapting to the context and also implementing the underlying principles and not just being caught within a script.
Right.
And that's not...
We call integrity of implementation as opposed to fidelity, which is that fidelity would imply you're going to really adhere to the original. And integrity flexes that idea a bit. It says, if you adhere to the core principles, just as you've said, and perhaps some underlying structure, which is what we how we think about the kernels, then you are adhering to the core idea and the spirit and the key elements of something.
Yeah. Gene Colburn wrote, I think around 2003, a really important piece on going to scale. And she really talked about the fact that it requires a deep understanding of the underlying principles. And again, I go back therefore to the conversation we had about the kernels, which is there is the kernel. I can now understand what the mechanism is that creates the type of process that we want to see happening.
Right. And it also is something that I, if I'm not certain that I'm there yet, I can just do this thing, right? And feel confident that I'm doing something that is linked to evidence and can fit inside my work. And over time, my understanding will grow and it will change because I am making it my own.
That's right. Yep. And let me just add, I wanted to add a footnote to your correct discussion of how you got to the kernels and to strategies is while the research on evidence-based program talks about results were produced through the fidelity, what we also know is they don't replicate.
Because people are different. Yeah. Places are different and kids are different and needs are different and time is different.
Yeah. At a global implementation conference, I heard someone say, when an evidence-based program arrives in a new place, it's a promising practice.
Yeah, it's not an evidence-based program anymore because you don't have evidence from that place.
Exactly.
Right?
So let us segue to the last part of this conversation, and you really started to already. For people who are listening right now, and they really are hopefully doing good things already, and they want to do more, they often feel constrained. A lot of messages out there saying you can't really do things and make it work. What are the things that they can take away now and actually tomorrow or next week be implementing in their work?
That's such a good question, because I think that is the question that many people actually arrive with and hope to leave with something that helps them or is at least in response to that actual question. I think there are a number of things. I think the things that folks could leave with to consider for their own work are both theoretical and existential, but also quite specific and practical. And the theoretical and existential is, I think, going back to what we were just talking about, which is just the recognition that this work is already inside what we're doing. It's in the interactions we have. It's in our relationships. It's in the settings. It's already there. And so it's not actually, even if it may feel at times this way, it's not actually new or different or separate. It's already there. So one kind of theoretical existential thing to consider that is practical is to look inside and notice what you're already doing, you know, what's going and what's not going well. And there are routines for doing that kind of thing, whether you're a parent. I did this as a parent when I was struggling, or a teacher or an after-school provider or someone who's working in a library, a place where kids are and adults are and things are happening on the sports field. Like, one thing that helps that makes the theoretical and existential idea of the everyday of SEL practical is to go through a little reflective exercise. I actually think that this is fun to do. Partly because it's like a little bit of a mind movie idea, which is that you ask yourself, okay, what is my typical day like? What happens from start to finish in my work day or in my day with kids, when I'm at the library, as a parent, when I come home from work before the kids go to bed, like what happens? And it's like you put the little film in your head and you just imagine it through. So first I come home and then I do this and then this happens and then this happens, or I walk into the classroom or I'm in the classroom and the children come and then this happens, and you create a map, literally one you can write down, like a table or just a picture of the major things that happen. And then that's part one. Part two is, when in that map, do things predictably or consistently go well? And when do they go poorly? And what, let's pick one, whether it's going well or going poorly, because that happens to everybody. Pick one of those and say, okay, during that moment, which is pretty consistently going well or going poorly, what happens to me? What happens in my mind? What am I thinking? How am I feeling in my body? What's happening? And what are the kids doing, or what is my spouse doing? You can really apply this to any kind of particular thing. And what might I do differently or more? If it's not going well, what could I think or do differently? And if it's going well, what might I build on and do more of? And if it's going poorly, what might I do differently? And that might be reframing my thinking. It could be I'm going to pull in a strategy. It could be I'm going to get outside help. Like, it could be many different things, but it's just this like very simple. What did you say, David? All the change happens in the ordinary. So what I'm suggesting is like you can turn the ordinary into your own personal little bit of data that helps you decide something you might do the same or more or differently. And you can adopt a strategy in that moment, try it. And then the next time, reflect on the whole thing again. What worked? What didn't? What might I do differently? That's very sort of basic reflective practice that could be applied to anything. And it doesn't have to be a complex thing that you do. It could just be a very simple, practical thing that you do that helps you along a path.
That's very neat, Stephanie. When we were talking before about a project that we had developed with David Adams and the Urban Assembly, along with TeachStone, and we wanted to put cameras and audio into classrooms, David Adams' goal was so that teachers could be seeing what's happening and look at the moves they're making.
Yes.
What you're reminding us is that our brain is a camera.
Yes.
And if we can be mindful and recall what is happening and recreate it, we, for ourselves, don't have to wait for the video, right, the AI interpretation to get there. We can start making our own sense and really be that reflective practitioner that we want to be.
Yeah. One of the things I read maybe 10 years ago that I hang on to as a truth, but I've never been able to find it again. Maybe you know about it. I feel like it was in an Institute of Education Sciences practice guide focused on children's behavior. And I feel like what I read, and I believe it, but I'm not ever certain if I'm totally making up or elaborating what I read or if I actually read it, because I haven't found it again. I think what I read said that the act of noticing, the act of stepping back and saying, what is actually happening here? Of documenting a sequence of things, of looking closely. Project Zero says slow looking. Just taking the time to observe. That act itself shifts behavior problems by a tremendous amount without actually doing anything. So just having a sense of how things play out drives some sort of shift in something that you do, even without a specific thing that you've decided to do. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Like the act of just seeing can make a difference.
But what I'd say is, given what we know about how people work and develop, what you're saying is a very credible hypothesis that is likely to be the case.
Yeah.
And it's certainly also what people who are in organizational development and who coach leaders are when they say, go on the balcony and watch. And
yes.
It's not just so you can be strategic. It also shapes what you do.
Right.
When we become mindful.
Right. You're aware of things that you might not have been aware of before. And I think some might say, but we each completely appropriately bring our own experience, our own mindset, our own lens to our observation. And sometimes that plays out as one kind of bias or another. And I think that's perfectly like that, bringing that into the conversation about individual noticing is an important thing to remember. But at the same time, we're still experiencing what we experience with all of that stuff involved. And so it's not something that should stop us from trying to get inside and notice and slow down and think about what's happening around us in order to just decide what to do. Even if we don't get to that point, something might happen, but we might get to that point and say, oh gosh, it's not that all these kids are terrible or that I'm no good at whatever I'm doing. It's that they have this one moment and that moment doesn't go well and that might derail the other moments. And so maybe if I just do my work there, that could cascade into other things.
No, and I think you're right about, on the one hand, all cameras, not just people, bring their own subjectivity or their own frame. But you're speaking to your subjectivity. And so it would seem to me that what you're talking about is actionable. And then after I've done it, if it's still not successful, then what I might want to do is go to a colleague or go to my spouse and say, I'd like you to look at this picture too and tell me what you're seeing so we can look at it together.
Yes, but, totally.
But it's a perfectly appropriate first point of action to become reflective of yourself and to use your own brain.
Yeah. It's almost you're building your own little theory of change, right?
And at the same time, I would say, and I'm going to make a point and let you comment, and this could maybe be our last, is for people who are fortunate to be in places that are organized collaboratively, where they have colleagues and they have time to talk with each other.
Yeah.
What you're describing is something I imagine that could be done collectively as well.
Definitely. Yep. We actually do this with educators. We call it the pressure points activity. And you can adapt it in a million different ways, but it is exactly that. And we do it with educators or support educators to do it together in a community of practice or learning community of some type. Yeah.
Stephanie, I'm so happy to work and learn from and with you. And I'm really glad that our listeners can as well. So thank you very much for joining.
Thank you for having me. It has been delightful.
There's a river.